Starting on my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and on her left is Justice David Prosser. And in there's a vacant chair on the extreme left. Justice Patience Rogensack ordinarily sits there, but Justice Rogensack was on the Court of Appeals when this case was heard, and part of the panel heard it, and under the disqualification rules of the state, she doesn't sit again on the Supreme Court when the case is heard. So with those introductions made, we will call the first case, which is 030060 through 030062, In re the termination of parental rights to Zachary B., Monroe County Department of Human Services versus Kelly B. We will first hear from Ellen M. Thorne, who is the guardian ad litem representing the Monroe County Department of Human Services. Ms. Thorne.
Thank you. May it please the court. I represent the best interest of Zachary, Nathaniel, and Michael. And I'm joined here this morning by Attorney Carrie Sullivan Flock, who is Corporation Counsel and represents Monroe County Human Services. This is a case about three young brothers, the victims of incest, and whether or not their mother's due process rights were violated when they were removed from their home due to neglectful and dangerous circumstances, when their mother was given a permanency plan and failed to complete it, and after 1 year, a termination of parental rights petition was filed based solely on the grounds of incestuous parenthood. The jury found that there was incestuous parenthood, and a finding of unfitness was made, and the judge proceeded to the dispositional stage. I submit that this case, the statute is clear and unambiguous, that it has been upheld previously, and that it is the best interest of the children that is paramount, and not the victimization of the parent. Wisconsin Statute 48415 sub 7 provides that termination of parental rights, that there is a grounds for termination of parental rights if the parents are related by a degree of kinship closer than second cousins by either blood or adoption. The statute does not require, nor does it explore, the issue of whether one parent or another is the victim. The courts previously held that the state does have a compelling interest in protecting the welfare of children, protecting them from genetic and health problems, protecting them from the psychological confusion inherent in being raised in this type of family, protecting them from emotional damage, as well as the stigma and ostracism associated with being raised in an incestuous home.
Ms. Thorne, let me just ask a procedural question, if I might. It's my understanding that originally this matter was brought on two grounds. One, the incestuous parenthood issue, and the other, that there had been a CHIPS order in effect. Does the record reflect why the CHIPS grounds were withdrawn?
The CHIPS grounds were withdrawn. It was under continuing need of protection services and failure to remedy the conditions that resulted in the removal of the children from the home. Those grounds were withdrawn not because the mother had completed the permanency plan, and in fact the dispositional hearing and the testimony at the dispositional hearing verifies that, but I, as guardian ad litem along with Corporation Counsel, believed that in the interest of judicial economy that the faster way to proceed was with under 48415 sub 7. The additional thing was at that time Monroe County was mindful of Kelly B's situation and thought that maybe going through all of the literally dirty laundry and failure to remedy all of the circumstances in front of a jury for 2 to 3 days would not be something that would be appropriate at that time. The best interest of the children dictated certainly that termination was appropriate, and we believe that to be the case. However, termination under 415 sub 7 seemed to be the way to go rather than to pursue it on both grounds. And I think our brief reflects that an amended petition under the continuing need is still appropriate at this point.
Well, at the dispositional hearing, was there evidence presented in regard to the conditions in the home?
Yes. Both the conditions at the removal, which were atrocious, the developmental delays of the children, their poor health condition, and then the needs of the mother and her inability to complete one of the conditions in the permanency plan in the approximate 12, actually 13 months since the time the children were removed.
Counsel, I have a question. Justice Crooks, are you completed?
Yes. Yeah.
This is a kind of a follow-up question to Justice Crooks. Let's say that now I know a little more since you have answered some of my question, but if we were to find that the statute was unconstitutional as applied, could the county then come back on that on fitness on the ground as far as the CHIPS?
Under the continuing need? Yes. I don't think there's any any question that we couldn't. I think, though, that the statute is constitutional and that the case of Allen M. is not that much different than the case that we have here. In that case, or Kelly B. relies on that case to say that the nature of the incestuous relationship is so different that it is, although it was constitutional for Allen M., it is unconstitutional for her. And I would submit...
Counsel, if I may, just for clarification, is it your understanding that this is a facial attack on the statute or an as-applied attack?
I would say that the attack is on the constitutionality of the statute.
As it's not as applied, but as written?
As written. In fact, Kelly B. indicates that in her brief that the reason Allen M. was should not be followed is that there is the BLJ case had interceded in the meantime and it had an incorrect standard. I don't think that has any bearing at this point.
Page 5 of your opposing counsel's brief states that the facial validity of the statute is not at issue here. So
I apologize.
Well, I mean, you may agree or disagree. I just wanted that clarification because you said something that the statute, parentheses, as written, parentheses, is constitutional, and that's the way I heard your argument. And I just want to make sure what is being contested here, what is in issue. Is it your understanding that your opposing counsel is attacking the facial validity or as applied, the constitutionality as applied?
Well, I would just gather from that portion of the brief you just reviewed that it would be as applied. But I still believe that Allen M. is not a significantly different case. Those cases, or that case, involved similarities where we have three children born of parents living in a continuing relationship where the parents were adults at the time the children were born. In this case, there was one child who was conceived when the mother was a minor. The other two were born when she was 19 and 21 years old. The children at the time that they were brought into the system were significantly developmentally delayed. That's a similarity in both cases, and the parents were unable to complete permanency plans in both of those cases as well, yet the termination grounds was based solely on the incestuous parenthood. The question of whether the very nature of the relationship means that the statute is not applied in a constitutional manner raises all kinds of other questions. If we presume that a father-daughter incestuous relationship leads to an unconstitutional application, where does that analysis end? And does the trial court then have to make a determination in every circumstance? Does the age of the parent matter? If the mother is 18, is the constitutionality of the statute upheld? If it's victimization, if the mother is the older, more intelligent sister to a younger brother, then who's the victim in that case? Certainly it can't be based solely on the fact that one's the mother and one's the father. The analysis...
Why can't you base it, and I don't know if there's enough evidence in this record, why can't you say, here you have a mother who from the age of, 13, 12? Has been subject to sexual encounters with the father, with her father, resulting 5 years later, and this is a continuous path of contact, in the birth of one child, and then another year later or thereabouts, a second child, and within 1 or 2 years thereafter, a third child. You've got a pattern with a child that
would be sexual assault, right, under the statutes?
Under those facts situation.
And she's way below the age of consent.
The evidence is unclear with regard to when the sexual contact, and in fact, Kelly B. has testified in court and filed a police report contradicting the 12 and 13-year-old statement. Roger B. was not convicted of sexual assault, but of incest.
I understand that. But assuming the facts are as I set them forth, and as I said, they may not be borne out in the record, or they may be. Assuming those facts, why can't you carve out and say where the mother is a victim of sexual assault in an incest situation of this age, that to second time victimize the woman by taking away the children is unconstitutional?
I have two responses.
Just on the grounds of incest.
Right. I have two responses to that. First of all, when the legislature carved out the victim exception to sub 9, the sexual assault parentage and grounds for termination, they didn't touch the incest statute. Secondly, when does the victimization end? If Kelly B. has another child with her father when he's released from prison, is she still considered a victim?
You referred to her, right, that you were mindful of her condition, which I assume was a reference to her mental health.
She was not unlike many CHIPS parents in that she was a sympathetic person who was overwhelmed by life circumstances and had been dealt a bad hand. Our position is at some point we stop focusing on the victimization of the parents and have to look at the best interests of the children.
Well, that may be in any particular case, but can't you carve out a victim's exception to the statute and then see if it applies in the fact situations of the particular case? I think that's what the state's asking for.
Exactly. And I think that in this case, you may say it seems clear on one set of facts, and those are the facts that you enumerated. However, if you look at that, if you made that narrow of exception, what about? In Alan M., we have a brother who apparently is older and higher functioning and non-cooperative, and Tiffany, the mother, who may very well be a victim. But the legislature doesn't require the trial court to go through that analysis. And at what point then, again, if it's an aunt and uncle relationship, if it is the victim of sexual assault, again, I think that the legislature could have made that exception at the time they carved out the exception in the sexual assault statute. And if that were the case, we would have to do, a trial on a sexual assault basis along with the TPR basis.
So can the court interpret the statute as not applying to victims, and therefore we could avoid this constitutional issue, whether it's facial or as applied, or must?
I don't think the incest criminal statute lists a victim. If you look at it from a very calculated point of view, both of them are perpetrators of incest after she's reached the age of 21. And I don't think the statute as written carves out any exception for the victims of sexual assault.
Justice Prosser.
Subsection 7, all the parties seem to agree is constitutional. And the question is whether it's constitutional as applied. Are there any cases in which you believe it would be unconstitutional to apply this statute?
I would submit no, because you have to look at the totality of the circumstances. If children are not removed from the home unless there is a significant problem, dangerous conditions. They're not subject to a CHIPS petition unless they're in need of protection and services and their needs aren't being met. Incest is not a grounds for removal, nor is it a grounds for a CHIPS petition. It is only when you get to the TPR stage that it's a grounds. So if, and then the court has the determination of unfitness that it can make, of whether termination is in the best interest, it can dismiss the petition. And if you think of a very sympathetic situation where the child is born, Human Services has no grounds to take that child from the hospital or from the home if the parent is appropriate, unless the grounds for removal apply. Human Services has no grounds to enter a CHIPS order to bring that child into the juvenile court system unless there is abuse or neglect or some other grounds under 4813. It's only those rights are there. You don't get a child into the system at TPR unless they've been through that. And if you think about it, if the child is in the home and being parented appropriately, it would be a rare, I can't imagine a situation where a judge would say it's in the best interest of the child to terminate the relationship with a perfectly appropriate parent who has been providing care, who's never been under the scrutiny of Human Services or had a permanency plan that was met or not met. The unfitness, that would be the most egregious circumstance that I could say, where the county would take a child without any other showing, but then the protections of the dismissal, the trial court's discretion to dismiss the petition, save that.
One other question. The brief uses the term developmentally delayed, and you use that in your argument here. What does that mean?
The youngest, they're not meeting normal developmental milestones. At the time these children were removed from the home, the youngest child was 7 months old and could not lift his head up. The older two children were 2.5 and 3.5. They did not speak except minimally. They were not toilet trained. They were not physically meeting the milestones that one would expect of a child who is receiving the appropriate care and stimulation in the household.
Well developmentally delayed, is that something that is permanent or can it be addressed?
It can be both. Developmental disabilities can be low IQ, and that would be permanent. The children in this case, Michael, who was in the household for the shortest amount of time, rebounded extraordinarily and no longer is considered to be delayed. The older two are still delayed and in need of special services that they are receiving. So they've made progress, but they still qualify as developmentally delayed.
Counsel, do you know if the statutes of any other state which address incest as a grounds for termination allow for termination based on the ground of incest for the victim as well as the perpetrator?
To the best of my knowledge, other states don't have an incest grounds for termination.
Well, I have before me at least several states that do. And, boy, my read of these is quick. And under the best of circumstances, it might be questionable. And I think the best of circumstances isn't the lighting here today. But my read of the statute, for instance, in Indiana and in Maine and in Missouri, at least, only provide for termination with regard to incest if there has been a conviction based on a crime that they must have of incest. So it appears to me, again, on a rather quick read, that it just, with those states, it just deals with the perpetrator of incest who's been convicted.
Well, That would probably, if that law were applicable, it would, and required in Wisconsin, it would require or prevent a termination for Zachary. But under the law in the state of Wisconsin, the criminal law, Mom could have been prosecuted. I mean, isn't that really re-victimizing the victim at that point? I mean, it doesn't seem to have a real common sense purpose. Is it a, so the counties have to, the corporation counsel and the district attorneys have to work together to ensure there's a conviction when it really, it doesn't mean a conviction and going to prison, so she's away from the children. I don't think that that's required. For instance, in Allen M., that there could have been a conviction for incest in that case as well. It doesn't seem to me to be a real distinguishing factor.
Of what import is the factor in the Allen M. case that the siblings were engaged in an ongoing relationship? That question comes to mind by the first comments that you made at oral argument. That is, you wanted to make sure that the children be relieved of the stigma of being raised in an incestuous home. The Allen M. facts, as I recall them, included that the siblings were continuing in a parenting relationship and an incestuous relationship. Those facts don't appear to be in this case, and so what moment should or import should we attribute to this stigma of being raised in an incestuous home in a continuing incestuous relationship?
I'm on my last 5 minutes. This case, Mom did continue to reside with Dad until the time that he was arrested. They resided together, raised these children together, and parented them together. The stigma is still there. There's still the whole mom-sister issue, brother-uncle issue.
So it's your position, as I understand it, in response to Justice Cross's question also, where you said there's no exception, that any time a child is the result of an incestuous relationship, you know, uncle, age 42, rapes 16-year-old, that statutorily means the 16-year-old is unfit to mother, is an unfit parent for that child.
Statutorily, it means that in the real world, you don't ever get there if the 16-year-old is providing for her children. You only get these children in placement when their conditions in their home are so egregious that it's imperative to their welfare and safety.
Well, you have grounds. I never know what all of the DAs and the county corps councils are going to do in this state, so I always have to rely on what the statute says. And the grounds are that if there's incest, you're unfit, and that's the way you interpret it. It's your position, then if there's a saving grace, it is in the second step, that is under 48.426, when the court considers the best interest of the children. But if the county or state would file TPR shortly after birth, as I understand those factors, the court is required to consider the following: the likelihood of adoption, the age of the child, whether or not there's a substantial relationship, the wishes of the child, the duration of the separation, and whether or not the child will be able to enter into a stable and permanent relationship, more stable and permanent relationship. And that's all that the court is statutorily mandated to consider during that second step.
Correct. And the unfitness, the petition can be dismissed immediately by the court without going into that next analysis. It's not the three-part situation, whether the facts were so egregious.
You take 48.427 sub 2 to authorize that there can be a dismissal after the first prong rather than the second prong?
Yes.
Isn't 48.427, I might be wrong, I thought that was entitled in part of the dispositional section.
Well, in 48.424 sub 4 says the court, upon a finding of unfitness, may dismiss the petition. And if you look at the factors, even if you get to the dispositional order, the factors, the length of the separation, in the circumstance you described, there would be no separation of the child from his parent. The child would be raised by the parent in the home unless there's grounds for removal, unless there's grounds for a permanency plan.
So your view is the statute is constitutional, and that as soon as an incestuous relationship and the birth of a child are proved, that is, on a jury finding, grounds for termination.
It equals a finding of unfitness, which is grounds for termination.
Okay. And then the trial court can say, as part of the dispositional state or an immediate dismissal, but despite this finding, despite the incest, we're not going to remove the child from the home because the mother is really fit. She's done a good job with the kids.
That's correct, and I'm at the end of my time.
Thank you, counsel. And you have, are there any other questions? You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
We hear now from Attorney Tim A. Provis, who represents Kelly B. Counsel.
Good morning. Excuse me. Good morning, Your Honors. My name's Tim Provis. I wrote Kelly B.'s brief. As you know, I like to, after I've for sure gotten the standard of review down, like to simply focus the court's discussion or attention on the principles I think should guide the decision. And the principle here is obviously that due process requires that before the care, custody, and control of a natural parent, of a child of a natural parent can be removed, that clear and convincing evidence of that individual parent's unfitness be shown to a court. With that deciding principle in mind, it's time to go to your questions.
Who defines unfitness?
It's clear now since, and this court made it clear in Julie A.B., that since the statutory change in 1988, it's the legislature defines unfitness.
And, well, it did here.
And the legislature defined unfitness as incestual parentage.
In this statute, yes, Your Honor.
So why are we here?
Well, let's see if I can jump. It's always a mistake to do that, but let me see if I can jump ahead to what you're implying there. I was going to state this in answer to a different question, but the court's obligation is, this is, I'm quoting from Planned Parenthood of Southeastern Pennsylvania versus Casey, our obligation is to define the liberty of all, not to mandate our own moral code. So while it's true there is, the legislature defines unfitness, there is still a zone of protected liberty which the legislature could not intrude upon. And, of course, that's what I'm saying has happened here in its definitions.
Well, the statute would apply to the father in this case.
Yes, Your Honor.
You have no problem with that, do you?
Well, I don't know. I mean, if the father was a victim, I would have a problem with it.
Let me give you a hypothetical. Suppose Kelly B. has these three children, and suppose the court were to hold
the statute unconstitutional as applied. And, oh, 15 years from now, Kelly has sexual relations with her oldest son and bears a child. May the state terminate her parental rights to that child, and may the state terminate parental rights of, I think it would be Zachary's child.
Well, Your Honor, I think we're, the law presumes that a child, if you're using the legal meaning of child, can't give consent. And so the child in that case is a victim. And yes, if Kelly is going to perpetrate something on her own children, she would be subject to having her children taken away from her under that statute.
Well, but
Your Honor, I'm not the smartest lawyer on the planet. Maybe I don't get the thrust of your question.
Well, why is it that you could take a child away from Kelly 20 years from now if the father was her own son, but you can't take the child away from her now when the father is her father?
Well, I mean, Kelly has done something. I mean, Kelly has, in the hypothetical you're suggesting, later down the road, Kelly has perpetrated a crime on her own child. Whereas she has not done that here.
Well, let's take the first child. The first child of Kelly was conceived when Kelly was 17 and was born when Kelly was 17. But the second and third children were both conceived and born when Kelly was an adult. Is there a distinction there?
Well, on the facts of this case, there isn't. It's because this was a continuing abusive relationship. That's why what the brief of the private amicus is all about. Now, it's true, Your Honor, that the court, when it found Kelly was a victim, both in the criminal case and in the TPR case, did not make a specific factual finding that she was a victim when she was over the age of consent. However, there are no facts showing otherwise. The facts show that Kelly was kept dependent in the house. She was withdrawn from high school, had no job skills for all those years until she finally decided to say something. And that's typical in these cases, and may be implied from the trial court's factual finding that she was a victim. Maybe implied by this court. And, of course, was implied by the lower court.
But you didn't find any authority that, as I read the briefs, either on either side, that a parent has a fundamental liberty interest in raising a child that has came out of an incestuous relationship.
No, Your Honor.
So,
and I would not contend that.
So basically, the court is in what, uncharted ground here?
Absolutely, Your Honor. That's why we usually come to this level.
But the opposing counsel indicated that here, and she is basing much of her argument that when we look at the statute, of course you have the statute saying that you can terminate because of incest, and secondly, we look at the let's say, the best interest of the child. The way you read this, that the first part of as applied is that because Kelly B. was a victim, then clearly she was a victim all the way through from, you know, the 17 to 21, from child 1 to child 3.
On the facts of this case, yes, Your Honor. Also, in answer to your question, I suppose I should point out something that everybody knows, that the best interests of the child don't come into this discussion until after there's been a finding of unfitness by a court or jury.
You agree with your opposing counsel that the court has authority to dismiss the action after the first prong of the test, that is, there has been a factual determination that grounds exist and a finding of unfitness. Your opposing counsel referred as authority for that to (48.424)(4). That is the section under the fact-finding hearing. But as I read (4), it merely makes reference to the fact that you can do it after the after the second prong, that is, after the disposition. (4) indicates if grounds for the termination of parental rights are found, the court shall find the parent unfit. A finding of unfitness shall not preclude a dismissal of a petition under 48.427(2). And, of course, 48.427(2) is the dismissal that's referred to at the second prong that says the court may dismiss the petition if it finds the evidence doesn't warrant it, and that's with regard to the disposition.
As I read the statute, the court here, after, let's say, as in this case, after a jury finds unfitness, the court could dismiss the petition, or it might wait until the beginning of the disposition hearing to dismiss, if the court made the determination under, first the court would have to make the determination under 427(2) that it found that the evidence does not warrant termination.
You know the answer or don't? I mean, maybe I'm asking something that you haven't considered before. So
The court can dismiss even though there has been a finding of unfitness. I agree with that. That's what the statute means to me. But I don't understand why that's relevant to this case under the state of the current law. Or would you want to enlighten me?
No light today. Let's just say the light shines in the darkness, but the darkness grasps but not. How's that?
Thank you, Your Honor. That is to say, in this case, we're arguing about whether it's a proper finding or whether the legislature made a proper definition of unfitness.
May I ask this question?
Yes, Your Honor.
In this case, two of the children were conceived and born when Kelly was an adult. Mm-hmm. There is a statute, 944-06, titled incest.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the incest with a child statute.
Mm-hmm.
But it provides whoever has non-marital sexual intercourse with a person he or she knows is a blood relative, and such relative is in fact related in a degree within which the marriage of the person is prohibited by law of this state, is guilty of a Class F felony.
So in other words, excuse me, Your Honor, you read that as a strict liability statute?
Well, there's knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
There's knowledge.
Okay.
Basically, my question is this. If the state, if there were no statute of limitations problems, if the state chose to prosecute Kelly mm-hmm. for the second and third children,
mm-hmm.
what would the defense be?
Well, it'd probably be a lot similar to what we're talking about here, is that the statute shouldn't be applied to her as a victim.
Well, suppose there were a fourth or a fifth or a sixth?
It would be the same, wouldn't it? If the father's going to continue to assault the child, I mean, nothing has changed, right? Even though she's of age, she's not. No one has made a finding in this case. There is no fact to support that Kelly consented to any of this. They want to point to how she recanted, but at father's sentencing, but that is typical of the abusive relationship, as is pointed out in the private amici's brief. If they wanted a prosecutor for incest, fine. You know, if they thought there were some facts. But I think that's the reason they didn't prosecute her for, because there weren't any.
Well, your answer would be if there had been no relationship prior to age 18, but then, let's say, hypothetically, we're talking about a case where the first relationship happened at age 18, then there would be a possible prosecution against both parties.
Yes, Your Honor. Am I interrupting you? Yes, Your Honor, I looked at the statutes I looked at the case law about victims of incest, and I didn't cite it in my brief or you know, bring it with me or anything, but when you go way back to the first case I could find in Wisconsin history about a victim of incest, they said it's a factual question. Certainly the lady could be prosecuted as a participant in incest, but it's a factual issue as to whether she actually was a victim and should be.
Have the facts been determined that she was a victim and not consenting with respect to those?
Yes, I covered that in answer to one of your earlier questions, Your Honor. Yes, it's clear that there has been no specific finding by the trial court that she was a victim after the age of consent. Nevertheless, the court did find she was a victim in both cases, specifically said she was the victim in both cases. And the court may imply that the court below did imply, and this court may continue to imply, that she continued to be the victim throughout this relationship. That is to say, it is within the purview of the circuit court to be aware of the pattern of an abusive relationship and to make a finding of victimization based on that, as it is well within this Court's purview.
Perhaps we could start at the beginning of the legal analysis, as I understand it.
Yes, Your Honor.
This is an as-applied substantive due process challenge to this statute.
Excuse me, Your Honor. Substantive.
Yes, that's what I said. An as-applied substantive due process challenge to the statute. It involves an assertion of an unenumerated constitutional liberty interest in the right to parent one's own child, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And I think it's your argument that this right is recognized or should be recognized as a fundamental right for purposes of determining which level of scrutiny applies. Is that right?
Once it's shown that the hurdle to get over, as you well know, is that the biology alone doesn't create the right. Has to be a substantial relationship.
Right, and that, I think, is, according to your argument, established here, so that this is a fundamental, unenumerated constitutional right.
Absolutely.
Liberty interest deserving of substantive due process protection under the 14th Amendment.
Absolutely.
Okay. Then the level of scrutiny that applies is what?
Strict scrutiny.
Which involves what sort of balancing?
Well, Justice Black was one of the first ones who says, I don't agree with that, is balancing stuff. Either you got it right or you don't. And I've always liked Hugo Black's thing there. And so what I'm saying is, first of all, well, you understand this clearly. First of all, the state says we have a compelling interest in termination. And all that has to be, the only review of that is, well, is there a rational basis for that? Then if there is a claim of, if there's a right that is, as you say, unenumerated right, which is entitled to protection, then I shoot back and I say, but strict scrutiny. You must show that the means chosen by the state are narrowly tailored to achieve the ends that the compelling interest is aimed at.
So that's our standard of review.
Yes, Your Honor.
And how does that play out here in terms of the statutory scheme?
Well, this one is an easy one. They never tried to. The statute is not narrowly drawn. The statute is sort of a meat-ex kind of statute. It says we don't care if, I don't believe the legislature intended it to apply here, but because it is not ambiguous. I can't really make the – in the court below, I did make a statutory argument because I wanted the Court of Appeals to feel that if it could find some way that says it was ambiguous, it could avoid the constitutional issue, which, you know, you all like to do if you can. But I didn't raise that here, and the amici instead argued that.
If you had to identify what the state's compelling interest mm-hmm. is, what would you say?
The state's compelling interest throughout 48.415 is to protect children from parents who are unfit.
Okay, and so you can see that that's a compelling state interest for purposes
of course.
Scrutiny? Okay. And as far as the statute's narrow tailoring or not narrow tailoring to achieve that compelling state interest, how is it that the first of all, before I ask the bottom line question, the mother's status as the victim of incest in this case can be considered in the dispositional phase, correct?
Well, Justice Bradley went through a whole big long thing trying to get counsel to say that that was the case, and I think the conclusion was the statute didn't specifically mention it, but I don't think there's anything in the statutes that would preclude the circuit court from considering it, no.
Okay, and so as long as her status as the victim of the incest can be considered at the dispositional phase before an order terminating her rights is entered, how is the fact that it is not a factor at the unfitness stage implicated here? Or how does it, as long as it can be taken into consideration,
why doesn't that protect the constitutional rights?
Right.
Because parents have a certain fundamental liberty to raise their children if they have a substantial relationship. And
I don't disagree with that, and I don't think your opponent disagrees with that. Mm-hmm. And as that right is protected, it could be argued, as long as your client's status as the victim can be taken into consideration
but that is
before
pa-
the parental
me,
rights
Honor.
Are terminated.
Excuse me, Your Honor. We're always stepping on each other, and I beg your forgiveness. But that, what you're talking about is after she's already been found unfit.
But that's not the whole ball game, as they say. Her rights cannot be terminated at that stage.
Yes, Your Honor. Nevertheless, the constitutional rule is must show evidence clear and convincing of unfitness. And so I'm saying there has yet to be that shown at the fact-finding hearing where she had an opportunity to dispute it.
Well, right. As I understand your argument, though, it is that her status as the victim of incest is not taken into consideration in the determination of unfitness under this particular subsection of the TPR statute, which allows a finding of unfitness based on incestuous parenthood alone.
Yes, the statute did not. Apparently, the legislators were just not thinking clearly and did not consider that.
Well, in any event, it doesn't distinguish between victims and perpetrators.
The statute does not. Your Honor.
However, as long as her status as the parent's status as the victim of incest is taken into consideration at the dispositional phase before any violation of her parental rights through termination happens, how is her right violated?
Because the state has not shown that she is an unfit parent. It's shown only that in the legislature's view she is an incestuous parent. Nothing has been shown about her ability or lack of it to parent.
I suggest you might consider this. One, it's a violation of the state statute, because the state statute says, first, you have the right to be declared unfit. So if you just go to the dispositional stage, you have not adhered to the statute.
Oh. Well, commenting on your comment there, Your Honor, I think what you're aiming at is there's a procedural due process thing that's missing here.
That's correct.
And, of course, I agree with that.
Secondly, if you move to your constitutional argument, if you get rid of a finding of unfitness, then you are left with what is the best interests of the child. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So you might have parents that can handle the child. They might be parents of not the highest level of intellectual capacity or emotional stability. They might be parents who are poor. They might be parents who don't have the same standards of cleanliness and the ability to give the child all the extra things that many folks can do. And that there's this very nice, very well-to-do, very highly educated people who would like this child. And maybe you could argue that a child brought up in the second parent's home, second family's home, is really going to get a better shot at life. And then it might very well be in the child's best interests to go with the second family. Would that be constitutional?
No.
Why
your,
not?
Your Honor knows very well it wouldn't be, because the Constitution doesn't...
I don't know any such thing.
I'm not the expert here. The Constitution does not guarantee a child parenting by the best possible parent, but only by a fit parent.
And so when you take out the unfitness finding, you are in not only procedural due process or statutory due process, you are potentially in substantive due process. That's what you're arguing.
Yes, Your Honor. I think we're on the same wavelength there. Well, are you finished, Your Honor?
For the moment.
Let me put it, I hate hypotheticals, but let me put one to you. How is this case different from a parent who gives birth to a child who is A, mentally defective, B, paralyzed, or whatever? Their argument is, well, the fact of the incestuous parenthood means damage. Now, I can't dispute that it probably does mean, in most cases, psychological damage at least. The pediatrician here couldn't say whether the physical stuff was as a result of the gene nature or nurture, as it was put in the record. So she's given birth to a damaged child. So what? Parents give birth to damaged children all the time. It doesn't show they're unfit. It's my hypothetical. You want to let me have it or what?
You can't take away that child.
Not unless the parent's unfit and can't. Well, of course, unfitness sometimes is a different standard with the truly seriously.
Suppose that child was born in that condition because the mother took a narcotic.
Now you're getting somewhere.
Thank
now
you.
You're saying, now you're saying, whoops, mom has done something that caused this. And under the, we argue about this all the time, under the failure to assume responsibility. The Milwaukee County District Attorney says, I don't have to show anything after they were born. I only have to show if they took drugs while they were pregnant. And we're going to hopefully argue that in the higher courts and find out if that's okay.
Why isn't this the same thing?
Same thing as where... Why is it the same thing as a parent who took drugs
sure.
during pregnancy?
Sure.
Well, for heaven's sake, Your Honor.
It's fairly well known that the chances of genetic defects increase
mm-hmm.
to the extent that there is a very close biological
certainly.
Relationship.
Certainly. If Kelly had any choice in the matter, that would be different.
But your defense, your whole thing is processed, or premised, I should say, on the concept that she's the victim, and that under Justice Prosser's adult incest statute, you'd plead a defense, whether it be statutory coercion, which I don't think she would necessarily fit under, or a common law kind of defense.
Yes, Your Honor, that would be an interesting argument, which I'm glad I didn't have to be involved in this case. But as I said, I researched that on victims of incest, and the earliest Wisconsin case I could find clearly said it's a factual issue. There was a, the issue was, well, can the woman be prosecuted here? And the court said it was a factual issue, and the court below found it as a fact, and so get out of here.
Are there any further questions?
I still have a little bit of time, Your Honor, and what I would like to do with that, what I would like to do with that time is express my clients and my heartfelt and deepest thanks to the public amici who worked pro bono on this case. That would be Attorney Bucho for White, Hirschbeck, and Dudek, and I want to thank the partners there for allowing her to take her time out from her schedule to do that. I want to thank Ava Schifrin and Carol Medaris, who also signed the private amici brief. Their service to the court here was in the best interest of justice and in the finest traditions of the Wisconsin Bar. And I certainly want to thank the public amici. It's a rare pleasure for me to be on the same side as the state of Wisconsin. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Thorne.
I differ with counsel on several aspects, but one of them is his contention that the best interest of the children doesn't come in until the dispositional stage. Under this statute, and the purpose and the legislative intent is the best interest of the children should always be considered in construing this. And the purpose of the statute specifically talks about the need for children to be removed from dangerous families and for permanency, and that time is not in their favor. The best interest exists throughout the statute. It just doesn't show up for the first time at disposition. It is the compelling and the predominant interest at the dispositional stage, but it is a concern all the way through this.
Counsel, as I recall the Sheboygan County case, I think it's also Julie A.B., the discussion there, in my mind, made it clear that the TPR, the Termination of Parental Rights Procedure, is a two-pronged procedure, and the second part of that procedure deals with what's in the best interest of the child. The first part of that procedure deals with whether or not there are grounds sufficient to constitute unfitness. Do you agree with that?
I do agree with that.
And so the first part of the TPR procedure does not inquire as to what's in the best interest of the child. Is that your, do you agree with that?
That is, I agree with that, but the participants in the court process, from human services to corp counsels to public defenders, are guided, well, public defenders know because they're guided by their clients' interests, by the best interests of the children. That is the prevailing concept, that this is the children's code. It's not the parents' code.
What do you do when you have this fact situation? 16-year-old for 2 years until her 15-year-old, for 3 years until her 18th birthday, is assaulted once a week by her father, and they have intercourse once a week. And she turns 18 on July 5th, and 7 days later, July 12th, again, she has intercourse with her father. Is she a victim, in your mind, on July 12th?
Legally, the capital V, is she a victim of sexual assault? No. Is she a victim of felony incest? No. The court, and I submit that the court in this case, was talking about the victim status as in general. Is she a victim, a sympathetic person? Is she deserving of some consideration and some acknowledgement of the terrible circumstances in which she was raised? Absolutely. But in this case, and I would submit that Kelly B., there was no finding regarding lack of consent, because none's required, when she's 17 and through 21. And that when the court is talking about her as a victim, they're talking about not as a victim of the crime of sexual assault. And in fact, Roger B. Won a motion to dismiss based on those grounds. That what we're when the court referred to her as a victim, we're talking about her not unlike many other CHIPS parents who come to the TPR stage and are the victims of physical, sexual, and emotional abuse as children, who are the victims of addiction, of disabilities who are low-functioning parents. And at the TPR stage, we don't say, let's look about their victims.
At the TPR stage, you say, we're going to terminate her parental rights because of abandonment. She's on cocaine and can't care of it because the child is in continuing need of protection and services, and they've failed to meet the requisite dispositional things for the statutory time period. So you can use all sorts of grounds to take care of all of those examples: cocaine, mentally ill, abused as a child, developmentally disabled, horrible ability of their mother. Use all of those other grounds, but you don't have those grounds here. You dismissed it. The only thing you have is incest, right?
That's correct. But if there were not all of those other grounds, we would have never been to this stage. We wouldn't have gotten here. If this is a child taken from the hospital, the other statutes, the other standards cannot be met. So there is the protection. The dismissal is the appropriate remedy.
I disagree with you, and I'd like you to take a look at that sub 4 that's part of the fact-finding hearing. That's 48.424 sub 4, because this is now the second time you've indicated they can be dismissed as part of the fact-finding hearing. How do you interpret the second sentence in sub 4? Maybe I'm misinterpreting. That second sentence says, a finding of unfitness shall not preclude a dismissal of a petition under 48.427 sub 2, which of course is the dismissal at the dispositional stage.
I am at the end of my time. It's 48.427, though, indicates that the court may dismiss the petition. And then it says, and under 48.427 or 424 sub 4, it says you go to the dispositional stage if you don't dismiss the petition. But in either event, the court, and I would consider a circumstance, I mean, the cases don't come in a vacuum, where the court, the jury returns a verdict of incestuous parenthood, and the court at that point can, just like a motion to overturn the verdict, would make that determination at that point, and frankly could, after hearing the dispositional information, make it again.
Counsel, I have just a procedural clarification of the statutory scheme. Is a CHIPS removal of the child and a CHIPS petition a statutory prerequisite to a TPR petition?
No.
In all situations?
No. Because you can't remove a child for incest. If that was the statutory prerequisite, the incest statute would never be applied.
Well, I'm not talking about in just cases of incest where that's the TPR grounds being alleged in the TPR position.
I don't know the answer to that.
It seems to me the argument that you're making is that everything's okay here because we're always going to have circumstances in addition to the incest in play, and they will be taken into consideration at the time of disposition when the totality is considered. That's how I understand your argument. And then you've also been saying that as a practical matter, there would have been a removal of the child from the home or from the hospital, depending upon the circumstances, that precedes any filing of a TPR petition. And that's what prompted my question. I don't know that that's, strictly speaking, statutorily required.
For instance, and it wouldn't come up in these situations, but when we do private TPRs in adoption, there's no CHIPS, there's no removal. So, no, you do not have to have a CHIPS to go through a voluntary or an involuntary termination of parental rights.
Let me just follow up on a prior question by Justice Sykes. In this situation, you dismissed a count that dealt with handling of the child or children. But when it got to the disposition stage, evidence of unfitness at that level was put in. And there are cases that say if things weren't so great at the
initial first prong hearing, the record can in effect be filled in by evidence taken at the second prong.
Okay.
So here in the second prong, let us just assume that you have a lot of evidence that this is an unfit mother on the basis of her care of the children. And then under ordinary circumstances, it would be CHIPS and grounds for termination. So the fact that all that evidence is in and the fact that she had an opportunity to rebut all that evidence, can that clean up the fact that a charge wasn't made at the first stage and therefore we never have to get to the incest issue because you've got it all cleaned up by CHIPS in effect?
Kind of a CHIPS without calling it that.
Well, or grounds for unfitness or grounds for a termination, because and the problem is you didn't give her notice. So she's only dealing with the second prong, not the first, but you, can you clean up that?
She had noticed that the CHIPS was the grounds for the termination all the way along.
Oh, but you withdrew it.
Right.
So now she's not on notice for that.
But
now you're bringing it in a second time. Is that good enough?
Because she has competent and very able trial counsel, she is prepared for a dispositional hearing that considers all of the factors under 48.426 that talks about the children, their health, the substantial relationship, the separation.
Look,
the
counsel,
stability.
My real question is,
does it, as a matter of, in this case, it cleans it up. Can you say that it would do it in all cases?
No, but in this case, it cleans it up. Does that mean we never have to get to the constitutional issue? Just say, hey, this was terrific on the basis of another ground for termination?
No.
That's where it ultimately
I think you do have to get to the constitutional issue.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? With that, the court concludes the hearing in the In Re Termination of Parental Rights involving Kelly B. And we are adjourned for our October sitting. The court will sit on Wednesday at a public hearing on a petition for rulemaking. Students who are going to remain to hear, and Justice Wilcox should remain. Anyone else may stay, and Justice Wilcox will be out shortly. With that, we are adjourned.